Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Nucleus Wealth Investment Insights. The topic and question for today is, has the Australian dollar bottomed? So we're going to explore the main drivers of the Aussie dollar. Then we'll have a look at the structure versus the cycle, and then the potential threat of Omicron. Then, as always, we're going to discuss our investment implications. My name's Sam Kerr. I'm the Senior Advisor at Nucleus Wealth, and I'll be the host of the show for today. As always, we have the Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. Damien, great to have you here as usual. How are you getting on today?
Thanks, Sam. Doing very well. It's a beautiful sunny day in Melbourne. I'm about to start pouring rain in a few hours' time. So,
yes. Fun and games. Yeah. That's Melbourne for you. And we also have David Llewellyn-Smith, the Chief Strategist at Nucleus Wealth. David, great to have you here as well. How are you today?
Very well, thank you, Sam. Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure. So just a quick reminder before we get started. If you enjoy our content, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and click the bell to be notified when we go live or we have a new episode recorded that you can watch. Alternatively, follow us on your preferred podcast platform. Our show is available on all the majors. For those people listening live today, feel free to drop your questions in the YouTube live stream chat below, and we'll do our best to answer them during the show. Now that we've got that little bit of housekeeping out of the way, we'll get into things. So, Damien and David, I'll hand it over to you guys.
Thanks, Sam. So, regular listeners will recognize some of the structure we're going to use today in this presentation. I'll probably just start by saying we're still very bearish the Australian dollar in structural terms, almost secular terms, I guess you could say, for this business cycle in general. The reason for that being largely that we see the US economy leading the cycle for a number of reasons, some of which we'll get into later in terms of cyclical analysis. But generally speaking, just having come out of the pandemic in reasonable shape with very deleveraged households from the previous cycle, certainly lots of corporate debt and trouble on that front, but a kind of sea change in his politics delivering fiscal leadership. And then conversely, we see China as lagging this cycle. So if you see US as the caboose, the engine, China is the caboose, where it's been the leader for the last couple of cycles. It's now got all of these structural debt overhangs that needs to address. And we're all familiar, I'm sure, with what's transpiring in the property development sector there now. Which we see as part of, the ongoing business cycle throughout. So just bear in mind that structurally we're still bearish the Australian dollar, even though a lot of this presentation will be more cyclical based, and obviously with some exposure to the trigger of Omicron, the peculiarly named mutant. So with that sort of framework, we'll probably jump straight into the structure that we generally use in these, which is our five drivers model for the Australian dollar value. And the first of those is, the first two of these are the big ones. Difficult to actually assess which would be the biggest. They're both very, very important. So in no particular order, in terms of the first two, we've got the terms of trade, which is really the measure. That's like a measure of the value of your exports divided by your imports. And so to some extent, it's a kind of measure of the wage of the nation. The terms of trade can be kind of considered a proxy, therefore, for a kind of global, Australia's position in global growth relative to global growth at any point.
And I guess the big picture sense for the terms of trade is, if everyone wants lots of stuff from Australia, then the Aussie dollar goes up, wages go up in Australia, it becomes cheaper for Australian workers to buy stuff from offshore.
Yep.
And then so we start importing more and the thing rebalances. And exactly. Vice versa, when it falls, It becomes more expensive for Australians to buy stuff offshore, so they start buying more stuff locally, and wages in Australia versus wages overseas take a tumble, and so more businesses start up in Australia or more manufacturing or whatever it is. You get that balancing out. So that's when Dave's talking about that. You know, and I guess the peculiarity with the Australian market is, versus most other countries, is the resource sector is so huge in Australia that that just distorts matters. So, you know, if you're Canada, you know, any European sort of developed countries, ex-Norway, then you don't have quite the same exposure to just a few of these commodities that really drives your terms of trade in one direction or the other.
It's much more typical of an emerging market.
Yes, exactly.
You're so exposed to commodities in your terms of trade, but Australia has mastered that nonetheless by kind of tacking on its postmodern financial system, which has delivered, as we know, some of the most expensive asset prices in the world. So we won't go there. But we've just passed through, over history, recent history, we've seen some huge spikes in the terms of trade, with the China boom obviously driving huge commodity prices and demand. Saw a big spike into 2008, then the GFC, then another big, even bigger spike after 2008, up to about 2011, before the Chinese really started to, kind of experiment with these property adjustments that they're so desperate to do and yet so fearful of in doing. We've had this extraordinary kind of post-COVID stimulus boom globally, and that's driven commodity prices very high, and including, iron ore to crazy levels, iron ore at $230-something, coke and coal at crazy prices, record prices, thermal coal the same.
Having said that, they've all come off now.
Oh, they have. Yes, that's most recently we've seen that. The three of those, typically speaking, comprise about half the terms of trade on the export side. And so that's in normal prices. So obviously as prices go nuts, their composition in the index goes up a lot. And so it also comes down a lot when they fall. And that's what's been happening through the last 6 months or so. We've obviously seen a record crash in iron ore. Then we saw the coal boom, which has now come off a lot and has a lot further to go. And in fact, I would argue that all three of them have a lot further to go. And that's what I've marked out in our chart so far. In fact, the retracement, the chart that I've drawn there, the retracement is probably a bit deeper than that now than my estimates. Some of that's lagging, so please forgive that. But I basically think through 2022, we're going to see ongoing property adjustment in China, notwithstanding some more stimulus that they've been providing to try and stop it from completely dragging the economy into a hard landing. I think that the property adjustment goes on. I'll just note that this case is ceteris paribus. So this is all things being equal, that Omicron doesn't derail things, which will come back. We're gonna do our scenarios for Omicron at the end and probabilities and stuff. So this is a sort of standing base case. I actually think as things stand, there are many, many things I could point to for what's coming in bulk commodities. Perhaps most pointedly, just 2 days ago, we got the latest steel PMI out of China. It is a wildly volatile index, but it's still useful. And it was the worst one I've ever seen in my 20 years of watching
this market. Sorry, the PMI is the Purchasing Manager Index, which basically trying to track, there's a survey of people who are buying in that industry. And they ask sort of questions about basically is this month better or worse than last month on a whole bunch of different measures.
Yeah. So we're at a depth that we didn't see in the GFC, the 2015 housing crash, or when the entire Chinese economy was shut down owing to the initial virus outbreak. So it's very bad in Chinese steel at the moment. And so that's obviously the key input into iron ore and coking coal, which is actually most of the index. Then thermal coal adds a little more on top of that. So the bottom line is we see in terms of trade continuing to fall, and so that's a big headwind for the Aussie dollar. The second big driver is interest rates, basically, and spreads between Australian interest rates and other jurisdictions, especially US, of course. And this goes back to what I started with. We still think that, you know, the US is the locomotive for the global cycle, and therefore, you know, owing as well to its virus experience and its fiscal leadership there. The economy has been hurtling along and has obviously created for itself something of an inflation problem. We don't think it's intrinsic. We still think it will deflate a lot next year. Nonetheless, it's clear that the Federal Reserve is spooked by it and has shifted towards both taper and faster interest rate hikes. So,
and it's worth saying as well, so your currencies are always a relative game, and we're talking about relative yields here. In terms of inflation, relative inflation, we're expecting the US to have more relative inflation than what we are in Australia.
Absolutely so. You know, we expect US inflation will calm down, but it'll still be much stronger. Well, it'll be materially stronger than the last cycle. And Australian inflation, we expect, will be kind of similar to the last cycle, still stuck in its low inflation environment. And that's because basically our policymakers are still very much trapped in the same mass immigration, housing, rent-seeking, a low productivity economic model that we saw emerge most strongly during the last cycle after the commodities bust in 2011-12. And you can see that Canberra is basically chomping at the bit to get back there as soon as possible. You can read the business press every single day, and every corporation in the country is screaming for open borders and more migration, because basically the economy restructured itself towards that feed of cheap foreign labour in the last cycle, and it doesn't work without it, which isn't to say it would stay that way if you stopped it. It would actually adjust to something else, but that's where all the interests are.
Yeah, and that's where, yeah, as we spoke about, that's where people and wage, you actually get some wage growth and workers benefit, whereas over the last cycle, it was very much a business-driven cycle, and business profitability has been great, and that's what they're keen to get that business profitability back to the same levels as what it was. So,
well, profitability is great in certain sectors that benefit from the model, but it's actually very poor
across the other
way, in general terms as well.
And as a productivity, it's one thing to say, okay, we're making, we're getting these productivity gains because we're getting to hire cheap workers. But on the flip side, you're giving it back, or a lot of it back, in terms of higher rents and higher sort of capital values. And you know, as a society, you know, you certainly say that's not a good trade-off. About saying, yeah, well, let's make people poorer and asset owners richer. But that's the model we're in at the moment, and that's the way you need to you look at your investments until we actually do see a steady change. Like, I mean,
there's an intrinsic problem with it as well in terms of the overweighting of finance and banks. It's becoming worse every cycle, because the closer we get to the zero bound for monetary policy, the more bank margins get squashed. And so banking profitability just keeps falling. So the more you push this model, the more troubled your profits become. So it's actually bad for corporations as well.
And eventually.
Just sequentially over each cycle, it gets worse. So it's bad for everybody except specific interests. And in Australia, sadly, it's the interests that win the day. So the upshot of that is you've got the US leading on interest rates and yield and growth and inflation on one hand, and Australia lagging in very much the same fashion as last cycle. And so
Australia leading in rent seeking, leading in immigration, low productivity, low wages.
Absolutely, leading from behind.
Yep.
And so at the moment, in most across most of the curve, Australia actually has a small yield advantage over the US. I would argue that that is completely mispriced. And it's probably just a legacy of the high commodity prices we've had in recent times.
And I'd argue as well that it's also a look look at similar countries, and in particular Canada and New Zealand, where you are seeing rates rise quite quickly, and an extrapolation of the trends there back to the Australian market, which we think are unjustified.
Absolutely. But if you look at this chart, I've just picked the five-year spread. There's lots of arguments about which duration is more important to the currency. Some would say 2, some 10. So I just picked 5, and they all look similar anyway. But at the moment, we've got a small positive spread, but we expect that that will turn negative relatively quickly and start to look very much like it did leading up to COVID, when, you know, we had the Trump tax cuts and stimulus driving a strong US economy, and we were still stuck in our backward-looking immigration rat wheel.
Yeah, that's right. We were. I mean, the big thing there was we had a slowing property market due to Royal Commission.
Oh, we did.
And then, you know, the reversal of that.
But again, I mean, even on that front, you know, the regulators are much more aware these days of how much debt overhang there is in the household sector.
Well, there's a lot more debt overhang as well.
There is. And so they use macroprudential these days to often slow that cycle before you get to interest rates even.
Sounds like you're arguing the case for Australian regulators doing a good job there, David.
Well, you know, we won't go there, don't we? But you know, they're doing what we told them to do. It's just that we told them in 2010. So in other words, again, all things being equal, and we'll come back to our Omicron scenarios, the second driver is also in the year or two ahead, pretty negative potentially for Australia as the Fed hikes and the RBA does not. We don't see the RBA hiking at all. The only way that that's got any plausibility is if the borders stay shut. So obviously Omicron may play a role, but we'll come back to that.
And so just one quick one on the yield, last one on the yield spread, just putting that into perspective again. So it's the idea from an investor who's not in Australia or the US, so say a European investor or a Japanese investor, if they're sitting there and saying, do I invest a dollar in Australia or do I invest a dollar in the US? Then if the yield's higher in the US, they're more likely to put it in there, and if the yield's lower, you know, vice versa. So, that's sort of the simple version. And then we've obviously gone into a bit more detail in terms of that.
Yeah, known as the carry trade, as it were. So some of the more minor drivers, although in the short term certainly important for the currency, are also looking a bit sick, to be honest. A lot of traders use technical analysis, so whether you agree with its objective force or not, it does operate, I think, with some reasonable credibility day to day, because people believe in it, especially in terms of just pivot levels and things.
The other thing I'd say with the technical analysis as well is sometimes for me, technical analysis is merely a sign that it's markets coming to more certainty. So for example, you look at one currency over the other one, or one stock versus another one, and decision making, hey, this looks actually really good for this currency, or this looks really good for this stock, but we're not absolutely certain. And then as each day goes past, you get more and more certain that that's getting closer and closer. And that's why you sort of sit in these trend lines where it's like, okay, we're headed towards, you know, this thing's, you know, going to go from A to B, but it's not the straight line. If it runs up too fast, it might pull back. And if it runs down too fast, but it's sort of like, you know, it's reflecting sometimes, not always, it is reflecting some of those underlying fundamentals, but just getting that as certainty. And so, we tend not to use technicals as a measure of exactly what to do, but we do use it as a bit of a measure to try and work out where we think we might be wrong. So it's a part about saying, well, if we think one thing and technicals are actually saying the opposite, we may end up still doing our original plan, but we do go back and re-examine those fundamental views with a lot more rigor and a lot more, in more depth, just to try and work out, is there something else that we might have missed that everyone else is seeing?
They can be useful for timing. So at the moment, there's a couple of basic patterns that work in the Aussie dollar. There's what is known as a descending triangle, which is a pretty bearish pattern, and we're sitting right on the support line for that. And if that breaks, that opens up, pretty material downside in technical terms. We've got the hint of a head and shoulders top as well, and a long-term kind of declining channel. So it's a pretty ordinary-looking technicals chart for the Aussie, which is not particularly meaningful. It's more academic to just look at it, but if it starts breaching some of these key support levels, then some of these patterns become active, and so the whatever case they're supporting gets stronger. And again, chiming in on that, and this is not necessarily bearish. In fact, could be argued is bullish. Sentiment is very bad for the Aussie dollar if we measure it in terms of the number of futures contracts outstanding.
That's the chart on the bottom.
It is, yes. This one's from CFTC. We're still very negative in terms of where the market's positioned on the Aussie. So sentiment's bad, but of course that means that if we get a turn for one reason or another, which could be Omicron, then there's potential for a short squeeze on all those people holding those contracts, and you could get actually a sharp rise off that kind of position.
So let me put that back into context, because I think with a lot of things, short selling and other things like that as well, is sort of similar in terms of what this chart's saying is there's a lot of traders making the bet that the Aussie dollar's going to go down.
Yeah.
And so notionally you go, yeah, that sounds bad. Okay. But the problem you get to is that if you get to a stage where so many have made that same bet, then there's basically no one else to come on and put that trade on. And there's sort of all you need is a few of those guys to start reversing, and then you actually get this short term push up. And so in my take for a lot of these, it's a mixture of the actual level and the momentum, which direction that level is going, that really drives those. And so, as David said, it's sort of like it's a complimentary sign that so many other people are taking that same view that the Australian dollar does need to go down, but it's that concerning part that hasn't yet fallen. And
yes, quite right. So that's very sentiment, but mixed in terms of potential market outcomes. So the last one, the key input that we look at is obviously the other side of the cross, which is the US dollar. And again, we come back to this notion that the US economy is really strong, with all these exceptional advantages, especially inflation and yield, etc. The other side of the cross matters a great deal, especially when it's the US dollar, because it drives so much global liquidity these days. It drives a lot of speculation or falling speculation in commodity prices. There's a lot of emerging market US dollar debt. A lot of the Chinese property shakeout is in US dollars. I mean, all these things matter when the US dollar is going up. And
just let me explain quickly as well. So the chart we've got up, we're about to have up, is often known as a DXY. That's what it's been titled. What it is, it's like a mixed version of the US dollar versus every other currency in relative to the size. So the biggest factor in it is what's the US to euro worth. A big factor as well is what's the US to Japanese yen worth. The US to Australia is quite a small measure of it. And then if you were to pick a country, say the US to New Zealand dollar, it hardly makes any difference at all to the overall the overall weight of this. So
in fact, the euro is so big in the DXY. I think it's over 40%.
Mm.
They're almost the only two that matter when you're calculating the basket.
Yes.
For DXY. And so that's why quite often, in fact, very regularly, within reason, the Australian dollar is almost a euro proxy at points, because if the euro is falling and DXY is rising, it's very difficult for the Australian dollar to rise. It does on occasion, but not very often, not very long. So anyway, at this point, you know, the US dollar has a very, very reliable business cycle pattern, which is called by some the US dollar smile. And that is, you know, each cycle ends with a big US dollar spike, you know, typically because the Fed is leading tightening. And then, you know, we reach a point where the business cycle, you know, needs to have some sort of consolidation. The Fed's overdone it. Then we get a market accident, and then, you know, there's a kind of safe haven trade into the US dollar. And so coming into every new cycle, the US dollar is typically very high. And then the moment we kind of get the green shoots in global growth and the safe haven trade into the US dollar starts to unwind, and the Fed, you know, is cutting into the new cycle, et cetera, and inflation's under control again. Not that that's been a huge issue in recent cycles. Then the US dollar falls away quite quickly. And so you get this pattern of like high US dollar at the beginning and end of cycles and then dipping through the middle. And it's called the US dollar smile. And you can see here that like, it's been pretty good over the last kind of 40 or 50 years, in fact. The last couple of cycles have been a little idiosyncratic as China arose, but this kind of pattern still was reasonably decent and predictable. And we've sort of seen an accelerated version of this over the last 2 years with the COVID cycle. As we've discussed many times, we've even called it at times the amphetamine cycle, because it's basically a business cycle on speed, because the crash down was so precipitous with lockdowns and the crash up was so steep with the extraordinary stimulus. And so we've had this accelerated cycle. So at this stage, I think we're well past kind of early cycle dynamics, the business cycle, we're also mid-cycle, and we seem to be hurtling towards late cycle, you know, just 2 years in. Anyway, that's an academic debate. But the US dollar smile seems to be working a treat again, this is business as usual. But the Fed.
But I guess the point you're making effectively, though, is if this was a normal sort of, you know, 5 to 10 year cycle, then you would be saying, okay, we're ready to start coming out the other side of the US dollar smile. You'd be saying, yeah, okay, we're still in the falling stage, and you know, we've got a couple of years of this. Whereas because everything's so condensed and so accelerated, it's actually way before you'd usually typically see this.
Exactly. Well, I mean, normally we'd have all of this loose capacity for years post a recession, you know, as balance sheets were consolidated and demand took a while to recover, and you know, all those kind of dynamics played out, but we just never got that this time because it was locked down and crash up.
And a lot of companies never went broke because they got too much support.
That's right. In terms of the, so very, very unusual cycle. So we seem to have accelerated through it really fast, and so we're left with many of the problems that a recession would normally clean out. You know, we've got choked supply chains and inflation, and we've got a lot of dead wood in the system as well. Zombie companies. You know, this US dollar smile has come early. So in short, The takeout from driver five is the US dollar is strong and increasingly so. But, of course, now we need to turn to what this discussion is really about, and that is, does Omicron change any of this? Because it was looking, that whole pattern was looking very, very strong and predictable as anything can be in markets. However, we've had the emergence of this Omicron strain, and markets are really wrestling with what it means, including in Forex terms, you know, and the volatility is very high because it's very unclear at this stage what it's going to mean. We don't, at this point, you know, we know that probably Omicron has got higher transmissibility than Delta. Whether or not it's more lethal is still in question. There are some beginning to argue it's less lethal. I think JPM came out today with Kolanovich, a very bullish guy, but he looked at the evidence so far on hospitalizations and concluded it may in fact be less toxic. But the jury is out.
Yeah,
at this stage.
So. And we'll see what we hit our probabilities on this next slide. But I guess our overall take is that if you said there was a three different types, it was harmless, disruptive, or harmful. The odds of it being really harmful would seem to be less than the other two, because if it was particularly harmful, chances are it would have shown up already.
You'd think so.
It might still happen, but yeah. But
it just diminishes the odds a little. Yeah.
Exactly. Every day that goes past without seeing this huge spike in deaths and huge spike in hospitalizations, it brings you one step closer to saying, okay, it's probably not as harmful. But for all we know, we might end up finding out that the period is way longer in which people have it, and it gets really bad in the last two or three weeks of the case or whatever it is. You're certainly not out of the woods, but I do think we can make the assessment that the initial signs are good.
I think that's right. Mm. Because the other factor in this is does it manage to circumvent the vaccines?
Mm.
And the news on that front is probably not so good. We've got some of the vaccine makers already declaring it pretty material risk for the efficacy of the vaccines. Although the jury is, very much out on that question as well. But a lot of the mutations, at least, were in the spike protein that the vaccines target. So.
But I guess you can say that glass is half empty. But the half full version of that as well is, look, they've shown the technology in terms of being able to create a new vaccine to target this virus really quickly. The odds are you could get, even in the hard situations, you can get some vaccines out. So then it is really just a matter of getting those approvals through. And I guess side note for Australia is actually ordering the vaccines as well. But, there's that. You are probably talking about a couple of months as opposed to,
I think Pfizer said 100 days to production.
Yeah, before you start to get that rollout, as opposed to
sort of March, if it turns out that it is necessary.
Yeah, and then I guess your production is obviously a lot stronger. I mean, it will take a while to ramp up, but production is obviously a lot stronger now globally versus what it was 2 years ago when we first started looking at this as an issue.
So, I think we can safely say we're not going to get repeated March 2020.
Mm.
Like we have swift access to vaccines.
Yep.
And it looks like it probably isn't as lethal. But you can't take any of that to the bank. But that's kind of today's rolling assessment.
Mm.
So what will Omicron do then? I mean, we've basically got to use probability analysis here to kind of couch where we think asset prices will go. So if it's harmless and basically does nothing, then it's certus paribus. We're back to our base case. The Fed tightens, China can keep its jackboot on property. We get the 2022 deflation wave as supply chains clear and commodity prices fall. US dollar strong and the AUD's still got big downside. And we've got about 40% probability on that one still. Scenario two is the kind of muddle through, I guess, the midway where Omicron is a bit of a problem. But then we've turned to the vaccines for help. It's perhaps not that lethal, so lockdowns are minimal. There's some more social distancing, but enough disruption that slows the Fed a little. Maybe
stops people spending on services, keeps travel down.
You get a little bit of the old K-shaped economy return. China, there's a bit of a continuum on these, as we've discussed. It's not just three scenarios. In fact, there's sort of infinite scenarios. But In scenario two, we feel like there's quite a number of graduations where you can go from, you know, from harmless to relatively harmful, in which you could see China or the Fed react very differently. And so this is the toughest one to kind of assess and call. If it's not too bad, then, you know, maybe the Fed just sticks to its taper timeline and just hoses off rate hikes. If it's the worst end of disruptive, you know, maybe it even pauses taper a little, not sure, but you can see how this analysis slides through the continuum.
And the other thing I'd say is that it's not a perfect correlation between how disruptive Omicron is and how much stimulation is. Like, I can see scenarios where China, you know, with a bit of disruption, China could easily decide to kick start the whole and just, you know, go again, same as they did in the COVID, and just say, yep, we're just going to spend more money on property and we'll push the problem out till things are a bit better. But by the same token, things could be quite disruptive and they decide not to. So, you know, it's a decision they've got to make, which we think it's correlated to how much disruption there is, but it is actually it's a different decision that's going to be made internally about how much pain are they willing to wear, how much economic pain are they going to, short-term economic pain are they willing to wear for a better long-term outcome.
Yeah.
And in the first run of the coronavirus, they basically took the view, which probably rightly so, is that, you know what, we're not taking short-term pain on property. We're actually going to throw a bunch of money at property, and that'll help get us through the whole demand crash that we saw in the first version. And so, you know, I guess, you know, in a way, it's probably just a preview. Like, Omicron being disruptive is probably just a bringing forward 3 or 6 months what they might have done otherwise. But the reality is we don't know what they're going to do. We think they'll probably reverse track and spend more money on property at some stage. But we do think they'll take more pain first. But exactly how much pain they'll decide to take is very unclear.
Well, the base case at the moment, you know, the Chinese are stimulating modestly across the board, everything except property, and even a little bit for property developers, just trying to give them access to liquidity. So, I mean, they've turned the corner in terms of tightening the screw. They are loosening the screw already a little.
Yeah.
But it's very calibrated, and it's clearly calculated to do just enough to stop it becoming a crisis. And if you added Omicron of some severity, and that obviously that's not going to be in China, because China's got a zero COVID policy still. But it would affect them via slowing in developed markets and their current export boom. So that might be why they turn it up a little.
But the flip side is that maybe if countries do start going back into lockdown again, is that we've seen, you know, goods really took this big jump up and services fell, and now they're starting to converge again. Maybe we just go back to more goods and fewer services.
Could actually go that way.
Which actually ends up being the opposite for China in terms of they're saying, well, now they've got more industrial production, and now they can actually even tighten the screws even harder.
It could. It's possible it does that as well. So, a real movable feast scenario too. I guess the most important kind of couple of points to make is that China's zero COVID, so it's going to be okay regardless. The US is, having led the vaccination wave, is actually pretty poorly vaccinated now, much worse than Australia. That's the key kind of point. And so if we did get a scenario in which China stimulated a little, the Fed backed off a little, and Australia's vaccination rate is so high versus the US, you can see a scenario in which a sort of China-Australia bid can express itself in Forex, basically. And so that's why we see, you know, the possibility of a Australian dollar rally there, sideways to up, until the kind of Omicron circumstance is cleared, which probably takes you through to mid-2022, I suppose. Until it starts to clear. And we've got like a 40% probability on that one as well. But as I said, a lot of moving parts in there. So that one's the one to watch closely. And then we tip over into Omicron harmful. And this one is not all that different to scenario two. It obviously disrupts growth and stuff. But because it hits things harder, you would get a shock, basically, we think, a market shock that would crash the AUD. You very much go, you know, Fed stops, China flood stimulates, and you come crashing out of it again. So you get a crash down and a crash up in the AUD and broader markets. And so that one's kind of a mini replication of March 2020.
Yes.
In which Omicron, say, circumvents the a lot of the vaccines and is a bit nasty as well for people's health.
So the scenario is you're basically looking at very similar to where we were. Death rate, say, might be 5% or something like that, significantly level high enough that even countries that don't want to go back into lockdown actually just say, well, given the harm, we will go back into lockdown. You'll get more stimulus from federal and state governments because you're back in the same part where I think everyone's seen the playbook and they basically, well, it worked last time. We just need to roll that back out again and wait for the next wave of vaccines to come through. And so, still a dangerous one, but I think there's Dave was talking about being, you know, having less of a fall than what we saw during the original one, because there's just not as many unknowns.
Yeah.
It's basically, we've seen what happens if we do this.
And a much swifter path to vaccines.
And quite possibly you can see the markets, you know, probably more so in the currency, less so in the currency, but you'd see maybe equity markets might not fall that much at all, because, you might get a 5, 10% fall and then all these announcements about stimulus and, you know, it's the Pavlov's bell ringing and,
yes, that's
and
right.
The market salivates and, you know, we're off to dinner.
Yeah, these days. And so that more or less wraps us up here. So I guess I'd ask you, Sam, have we got any questions there?
Yeah, we've got a couple of viewer questions. So we've got one from John that I think is relevant to a lot of people at the moment. So he's wanting to invest, but he feels there's a lot of uncertainty, and he's wondering whether he should invest now or wait till the picture's clearer and then jump in the market. Well, let's assume John's a long-term investor. What would you guys say to that?
Yeah, look, this is a perennial problem we have from a lot of people coming to us. I often take this view about for people saying, well, if you were invested, would you get out at this point? And that's often a key thing for people to at least crystallize in their own mind about what they should be doing. Because if you were invested and you wouldn't get out at this point, then you probably should be invested now. If John was coming to us and saying, I've got whatever, 10, 20 grand sitting in my, sitting in an account, and I'm going to be adding, a few grand a month into that or a few grand a quarter into that, I'm just going to be investing, over the next 10, 15 years, then I'd be saying, well, it doesn't really matter that much, your initial investment, you're actually getting that savings habit going and getting that money coming in and, that. Because you're going to average out over the next 20 years your entry point. So again, in that point, I'd say, look, just get started. The problem's always when people have this big cash amount. They're sitting there and they're saying, they've just sold a house or a business or something, and they're sitting there going, look, I've got whatever, a couple hundred thousand dollars sitting here. I want to put that in. I'm going to be adding a little bit over time, but really I've got this big amount and I don't want to invest right at the wrong time. The danger is there's always something out there that you can be concerned about. What I generally say to people on those situations is, look, you need to have a default position, which is you are going to invest. And your default position is you might be investing over a period of that you feel comfortable with. I'm saying, look, I want to be, I've got this big amount. I want to be fully invested within, say, 2 years or fully invested within 12 months or whatever the time frame is, and set yourself up to say, okay, I'm just going to start putting that in. Once a quarter, I'm going to say, say you've got your $200,000, you're just going to go, I'm going to put in $50,000 a quarter. And if the market does crash, then I can always speed that up. If I feel really nervous, you don't have to follow it. But what you want is your default position is you are actually starting to invest and starting to get into the market. Because I think at that point, otherwise your default position is I'm waiting until everything is perfectly right. The danger is you just never invest because nothing will ever be perfect and you never have the market fall to this level and people ringing the bells and saying, you know, there's no more, you know, nothing more to worry about. Now is exactly the time to get in. It's just not going to happen. So set yourself a default position, which is I will become invested, and then manage that. You know, you don't have to follow it, but it's much easier if you've sort of already set up your direct deposits or your B payments or whatever into your savings account and your investment account, and then because that'll give you a much better chance of actually being invested, you know, regardless of the scenario.
Yeah, thanks, Damien. I think that's a great answer, and yeah, that's how I'd answer as well. I think it's important to build that habit of regular long-term savings into whatever investment you choose to make, and get compounding, get that working for you. So, John, I hope that helps, and I hope that's relevant to anyone else out there with the same sort of dilemma.
And actually, one other thing I should add to that as well is, you know, assuming they're talking about investment in us, I guess that was sort of a general case about whether you're investing in anyone. Keep in mind, if you're looking to invest in say, Nucleus, we're also in our tactical funds, we're also doing that for you as well in terms of where we're cashing up and then moving out. And the danger you get sometimes is that you're basically doubling up on that. And so, you know, we're being conservative, you're being conservative as well. And so you end up being ultra conservative and then and missing even more of the concerns when even though we're quite conservative, we've still got investments in the market and we're still generating returns for customers in case we are wrong or in case things happen that, you know, new variants or other sort of windfalls that can drive markets higher. So yeah, just that danger of doubling up too much on that investment decision.
Yeah, that's a good point. And we've got one other question for you, David. This is from one of our viewers, Jude. So she's asking, from a macro perspective, is there one thing that makes you fearful? And is there one thing that makes you greedy?
Well, I don't really get emotional about these things anymore. I used to. but I guess fearful in the abstract, I fear for iron ore. So I think the Chinese really are serious about this property adjustment this time. And we may well go through a couple new mini cycles in credit and stuff, but it's going to take something very big to create any kind of sustained flood stimulus again. And so if you understand the numbers behind the importance of Chinese property and infrastructure to iron ore and their objectives, there's a lot of new material out this morning from China about a plan to wean themselves off Australian iron ore supply chains, then if you're rational, you could only be fearful for the future of iron ore and coking coal as well. So that's kind of, I think, a secular thing. I think the decline in iron ore from its recent tearaway prices is secular. So I'll say that is the one thing in markets that I look at and think, you know, they should be very afraid. Excited by, well, I mean, I actually think... if we can get through a decent kind of mid-cycle shakeout here, the prospects for ongoing returns are pretty good. You know, the US economy, despite its failure, I guess, to shake out some of its excesses from the last cycle, is still in rude health. Like, US households are absolutely in rude health. And so if we had a decent correction and we saw supply chains loosen up as we expect next year and commodity prices to crash, then I can see a few years ahead of terrific returns and margins in US businesses and you know, some really good stock market returns. It's just there's a couple of factors that kind of need to clear the way. This post-COVID choking is one. The other is overvaluation. Everything's so expensive and we need to see a correction to give us some value. But once we get past these things, and I do think that the virus variants you know, probably going to keep coming, but we'll just get better at seeing them off until eventually it is a flu-like phenomenon. So we get through the next year or so of these troubles, and we actually look forward to as an what I think as an Aussie investor is a fantastic opportunity as China slides and the US rises, because this presents the almost perfect scenario for a falling Australian dollar. That's again, you know, with provisos of virus shocks and things, and so to me, that's just like most media will look at the Australian dollar and think it's terrible. I mean, when we see it, we just think it's a brilliant opportunity, and it is fantastic opportunity for Australian investors to get their assets offshore and
before it falls. Before it falls. Yeah, once it's fallen, then you're
toast.
Then you're fighting it uphill
from there. Yes, that's right. But also your asset allocation locally, where you go in the equity market and stuff like it. You know, a sub 50 cent Australian dollar, which I still think is kind of inevitable over the next few years if we persist with this ridiculous falling living standards model that we've, you know, our pollies have embraced so fulsomely.
Yeah. I'm happy with under 60. I'm not quite sure.
If you got this scenario where you actually did have a US locomotive and a China caboose,
yeah,
you know, that is a scenario where you get to a 50 cent on the dollar if it rolls through for a 5 or 6 year cycle.
Yeah, yeah, yep.
You know, and you've got some of the pieces for
and Australia deciding to try and keep going with our old models.
Yes.
Yeah,
exactly. And all those pieces are in place.
Yes, that's right.
It doesn't mean it's going to happen.
I'm hopeful. I'm optimist. I'm hopeful that eventually, like, it would be hit over the head enough times and you go, oh, okay, maybe we shouldn't base our entire economy on these. You know, what worked in the early 2000s, maybe now we're 30 years on.
The beauty of macro is that the more you screw it up, then the more the natural checks and balances and it will adjust you anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, so the more we stuff this in policy, it's the lower the Australian dollar goes.
Yeah, exactly.
And so we actually end up getting to where we needed to go. We just could have done it 20 years earlier with high living standards.
Yeah, yeah. And take with a little bit of the carbon price as well in there, sort of sits the same way. And now we're looking at really high gas prices and really high coal prices, and it's like it's effectively a carbon tax helping you to accelerate the switch to renewables. But
happening. Yeah, look at what Australian households and their rooftops.
Yeah. Would have just been much nicer if that money was going back to the governments rather than off
right. So you can only game the system for so long. It's actually built to adjust and readjust.
Yeah.
And so I actually think potentially, you know, there's a really good cycle for Aussie investors.
So the net effect is, in terms of the under 50, the Aussie logo under 50 is, if you've got faith in the ineptitude of the Australian government and the... and you're effective taking a bet that they're not going to fix things until too late.
Yeah.
Then,
so you'll get a much lower dollar.
Yeah. Okay, got me on there.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's something to be bullish about, isn't it?
I'm hoping the ineptitude turns around and, you know, we finish off in the low 50s, but I can see, see the case that we're more inept than I hope.
Well, I mean, I've said this many times in these potties and stuff over the years. Having done this for a dozen or so years through macro business, I'm just shocked we can't find the bottom in terms of policy making quality.
Yeah.
Or lack thereof. Like it just keeps getting lower and lower. I don't know where the bottom is.
Mm.
You know. But I can say that we're at the bottom. Or we're as low as we've been in the last dozen years right now. Whether it's the bottom, who knows? But it hasn't been this bad.
Yeah. We thought we reached the bottom, and now we've started digging.
Yeah, so that's right. Not quite sure how. That's probably how we start the recycle. We need a new hole.
Quite sure how far we'll dig before we decide that.
I mean, go along digging a deeper hole.
Yes. Excellent. Anything else, Dan?
So we do have the viewer question for the week. So that's, has the Aussie dollar bottomed? So that's for the viewers to drop into the comments, have some discussion over the coming week. So feel free to do that at any time. That almost wraps us up. We do welcome your feedback on the show, especially in regards to suggestions for future topics. So if you do have any ideas, please drop it into the YouTube comments below or send us an email at contact@nucleuswealth. Just a reminder, this is general advice and does not take into account your personal situation. If you do want to discuss how you can personally take advantage of these global trends and themes in your personal portfolio, please go to our website and you can book a call with myself or call us on 1-300-623-863. Thanks for joining us today, Damien and David. Have you guys got any final comments?
Oh, thanks for having Sam.
Yeah, thanks, Sam.
Yeah, always insightful. And thanks again to everyone else who's been watching the episode live today and to everyone that's asked questions along the way. Don't forget to like the video now. And finally, if you know of anyone that might benefit from today's episode, I would appreciate it if you share it with them also. If you'd like to see some of our previous episodes and content, please head over to nucleuswealth.com/content. And to stay up to date with news from us, you can also follow us on social media. Thanks again for tuning in. From myself, Damien, David, and the rest of the team at Nucleus Wealth, we look forward to seeing you at our next episode. And bye for now.